Strahomas or Agami, maybe even the driver.
We'll get to it, said Collins. But keep in mind that this is a hit-and-run accident, not a terrorist threat to blow up the port of Miami.
The FBI wasn't the only law enforcement agency to feel the pinch of budgetary priorities.
I'll see if I can get assistance from my tech agents, said Andy.
The MDPD officers thanked her, and Andy excused herself. Octavio Alvarez was a major point of overlap between the heist and the hit-and-run, but Andy didn't want the MDPD traffic unit to become the proverbial tail wagging the dog. She found a quiet place in the parking lot, dialed Littleford, and quietly filled him in.
Can't think of a single good reason for an armored truck driver to be out on the street pretending to be homeless, said Littleford.
Neither can I, said Andy. I see this as a prearranged meeting to deliver to Alvarez his cut from the heist. He knew he'd be under FBI scrutiny, so he came disguised as homeless.
Why would he choose such a busy intersection at the height of rush hour?
The same reason a drug dealer chooses to make a drop on Lincoln Road Mall at lunchtime. If you don't totally trust the other side of the transaction, do it in a public place where you're less likely to end up staring down the barrel of a gun.
So no guns here, but they ran him over.
That's how I see it. This hit and run was no accident.
Is that what MDPD is saying?
Not yet, but look at the facts. No skid marks. I could see that with my own eyes. The driver put stolen tags on his vehicle to keep us from tracking him down. An accomplice on the street not only grabbed the backpack, but probably alerted the driver when Alvarez arrived. They knew Alvarez was going to be here today, ran him down, and took off with a backpack full of money.
We don't know that money was inside.
But it's a fair assumption, given what happened to Marco Arroyo. You predicted it. The crooks are turning against each other. Now we have two dead, and somewhere in this band of thieves is a pig collecting all the acorns.
Definitely plausible, said Littleford. Where do you want to go with this?
Surveillance.
On who?
Pinky. I spent all day Sunday tailing him on my own time. I emailed you some photographs. Did you look at them?
I did, said Littleford.
I see a resemblance to the armed suspect in the video from the MIA security cameras. Don't you?
I see two men wearing ski masks and dark sunglasses.
I'm talking about body type.
Yeah, I suppose there's some resemblance, said Littleford.
Enough to put a line in our budget for surveillance on him?
Enough to put a written commendation in your file for tailing him on your day off and on your own dime.
Gee, thanks.
Drawing conclusions from facial comparisons and photographs is difficult enough. I've used body comparisons to corroborate facial comparison, but a body comparison alone is pretty flimsy stuff. A noisy bus passed on the street spewing diesel fumes. Andy plugged one ear.
We're talking about one investigative tool, not the key piece of evidence in the criminal trial.
Does Pinky own a blue sedan like the one in the hit and run?
No, but he's done time for auto theft. He could have easily gotten his hands on one before coming here.
Let's wait and see. You did the right thing telling MDPD to check for video from private security cameras. If we get a good enough shot of the driver for our experts to do facial mapping and confirm some similarities to Pinky, I'll green light the surveillance.
By the time we get that video, Pinky could be long gone.
Do you have evidence that he's about to flee?
He's been living out of a hotel, never goes home.
If Priscilla over at Night Moves wasn't trying to be my new best friend, I would have never known where to find him.
Come on, boss. This is time sensitive. Are you really going to make me beg?
Don't beg, he said. And don't take this the wrong way, either,
But what?
He sighed so heavily that, even on the phone, Andy could feel the sage about to impart his wisdom.
It goes back to the unit assignment you requested when you transferred to Miami, he said. I'm still hoping you stay in bank robbery. But in the subconscious world of showing the FBI where you really belong, maybe a part of you wants the big break in this case to come from a lead you developed in an undercover role. Are you psychoanalyzing me, boss? It's called mentoring. Andy knew better than to disrespect a well-meaning supervisor, but it bugged her that he thought she was subconsciously angling for a way out of his bank robbery unit. Is that what you really think? Pinky's resemblance to the suspect in the warehouse video is me seeing what I want to see? A tattoo, a guy with one arm, or some other distinctive physical attribute would be one thing. But in this case, we can't even compare the guy's hands because the crooks were wearing gloves. If we could take grainy CCTV video and identify suspects based on subjective comparisons of body types, we'd have 100% arrest and conviction rate in every case involving cameras. Pinky isn't someone I plucked from the general population. He was Marco Arroyo's friend. I understand. You're leaving me no choice but to bring him in for questioning. As soon as I do, Pinky will book a one-way trip to Timbuktu, and he'll probably take Arroyo's and Alvarez's share of the heist with him. He paused, which Andy took as a sign that she was getting through to him. She pushed a little harder. Look, I totally get your message about the budget. I understand that everything we do in this unit needs to yield results. But I wouldn't have spent my day off following Pinky if I thought this was just a shot in the dark. There was silence on the line, which was better than a knee-jerk no. Another bus passed on the street, this one noisier than the last.
I tell you what, said Littleford.
I'll send it to the Digital Evidence Laboratory for a quick look and have a forensic expert compare your photographs to the security camera video. Maybe they'll latch onto something distinctive. And if the expert sees what I see, then what? I'll push through the funding for surveillance on Pinky. Yes. Thank you.
Don't thank me. Just catch me a crook before these dumb sons of bitches kill each other off and the money's gone for good.
You got it, said Andy.
Chapter 31. Reuben drove to his mother-in-law's house and waited until 11:30 a.m., which seemed long enough for the accident scene to clear. It was time to go back. The hit-and-run driver was Pinky. Reuben was almost sure of it. Who else knew about the prearranged meeting with Alvarez? Reuben had said too much, way too much, when he'd chewed Pinky out for dropping the ball on Marco's cut, for not making a plan like the one Reuben had made with Alvarez. Third Tuesday, 8 a.m., corner of US 1 Bird, boom. Octavio knows to be there. Thanks to Reuben. Pinky knew to be there, too. Pinky and his homeless friend, whoever he was. Reuben had to find out.
Beatriz, I need to borrow your car.
Reuben's car was in her garage, where it would stay. He had to assume that police would interview his homeless crew about the accident. Each was under a standing order never to tell the police who they worked for or how they got to the intersection, but these were not Navy SEALs, impervious to interrogation. They didn't know Reuben's name, but they could describe his vehicle. Never again would his wheels see the light of day.
Jeffrey needs my car to get his cereal when he wakes up, said Beatriz.
Cereal?
See? You wake up every day at noon? I ask Jeffrey, where you going? He say, to buy cornflakes.
Poor Beatriz, born long before the advent of the breakfast buffet code for drugs. Cornflakes was cocaine. Butter was crack. Cocoa Puffs were cocaine with marijuana and so on.
Fry him an egg, said Reuben. A vague allusion to the old public service announcement.
He grabbed the keys and was out the door. Rush hour had ended, but each November marked the return of snowbirds to Miami. So it took Reuben nearly an hour to drive through the gauntlet of New York, New Jersey, and Ontario license plates back to the intersection. Traffic had resumed a normal flow, no police tape or squad cars on the scene. The only sign of what had happened were the remains of expired road flares, a scorched chain of burn marks on the pavement. Reuben stopped at the red light, lowered the window, and waited for the homeless Iraq war vet to approach.
"Round up the crew," said Reuben.
"Huh?"
he said, not recognizing Reuben at first. Then it kicked in.
"Oh, hey! What do you mean, round everyone up? We're not even close to earning out."
He meant the daily $300 minimum. Reuben slipped him a 50.
"I'm covering you today. Get the group together and meet me at the entrance to the Metro rail station."
The traffic light changed, and Reuben drove around the block to the station. He parked the car, purchased 4 one-way rail passes from the machine, and waited outside the turnstiles. 5 minutes later, his crew walked up. It was turning into a hot day, and 4 hours of standing in the sun had his team sweating out some head-spinning odors. Reuben sat them down on a bench in the shade by the parking garage. The pregnant young woman, who wasn't actually pregnant, started to complain about cutting the day short, but Reuben made good on his promise to pay, which shut her up. Then he started his interrogation.
"There was a homeless guy selling grasshoppers made out of palm fronds this morning," said Reuben. "I need to find him. Anybody seen him before?"
The vet shook his head. So did the others.
"Did any of you see the accident this morning?"
"Saw it after it happened," said the vet.
"Did anyone actually see it happen?"
More shaking of heads.
"Did any of you talk to the police?"
Silence. Reuben had made it clear never to talk to the police, and he was sensing a breach of the rules.
"I'm not going to get mad at anyone for telling me what happened," he said as he opened his wallet. "There's another 50 here for anyone who cuts through the bullshit."
The vet spoke up.
"The cops interviewed all of us. Asked us the same questions you're asking now."
"What'd you tell them?"
"Nothing."
Reuben went right down the line. "You? You? You?" They all said the same. Nothing about the accident, nothing about the guy selling grasshoppers, nothing about their arrangement with Reuben. Reuben could have stopped there, but if Pinky had turned against him and Octavio, it was a declaration of war. He had to be absolutely sure. He searched the internet on his phone and found Pinky's mugshot from the Florida Department of Corrections website. He didn't want to plant his idea in their minds that Pinky had been the hit-and-run driver, so he kept his question general.
"Any of you seen this guy before?" he asked, showing the photo. 3 heads were shaking.
The vet took a closer look.
"Never seen him in person, but I saw his picture."
"When?"
"One of the cops showed me. Wanted to know if I ever seen him. Looks just like that guy there,"
he said, pointing at Reuben's phone.
"Which cop asked you that?"
"A woman. Don't know her name. She wasn't dressed like a cop."
Reuben recalled Octavio's description of the FBI agent who had interviewed him at Braxton.
"Was she good looking?"
"I'd do her."
"You'd do a fruit bat with rabies."
"She was very pretty," said the unpregnant woman.
Reuben elicited a few more details, then gave each of them another 50 and a one-way metro pass.
"I want all of you to go back downtown and keep your mouth shut. You got that?"
They nodded.
"Good," said Reuben. "Now get lost."
He watched them push through the turnstiles and made sure they got on the escalator leading to the elevated platform. Then he walked to his car. A bad day was only getting worse. A dead friend.
a backstabbing relative with an unknown accomplice, and now an FBI agent was on a trail that could lead her right through Pinky and all the way to Reuben. He got in the car and closed the door. His phone rang before he could start the engine. It was Jeffrey. Just what I need.
Bro, why'd you take the car? Asked Jeffrey. I gotta be somewhere.
I heard. Cornflakes run, huh? Jeffrey laughed the way druggies laugh when they thought they were so clever.
Yeah! Cornflakes! You got a problem with that?
I got more problems than you can imagine, but this one I can solve right now. I'm putting you on a diet. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure, bro. But that just makes more problems. If I don't get my cornflakes, my memory comes back. I start remembering shit like who was at the warehouse that night. Pretty sure it wasn't just me and my uncle. I seem to recall this third guy. It's still kind of fuzzy. I can see his face, but can't quite remember his name. Maybe Savannah would know it.
Reuben was seething. The contrite, boyish Jeffrey who had wanted Reuben's approval was gone. Drugs. You piece of shit. Are you threatening me?
No. You're doing this to yourself. I turn into a total asshole when I don't get my cornflakes. Pick some up on the way home.
He hung up. The screen on Reuben's phone went dark, but as he laid it on the console, an image reappeared. It was the mugshot of Pinky that he'd retrieved earlier. What a fucked up family, he said to himself, which triggered another thought entirely. He knew what drugs could do to someone's personality, but he wondered if Jeffrey's new attitude was more than just an addict in need of a fix. Reuben wondered if Uncle Douchebag had been talking to his nephew. Don't get paranoid. He started the engine, pulled away from the station, and drove toward Cafe Reuben, avoiding the intersection that had changed everything. Chapter 32. A text message told Reuben to meet Savannah at the bus stop at 6 p.m. Normally he picked her up right at the daycare center, but she didn't answer when he texted back to ask about the change. He spotted her at the bus shelter on the corner, seated on a bench, waiting. He pulled up to the curb and reached over to unlock the door. Savannah climbed into the passenger seat.
Why are you driving Mom's car? She asked.
Reuben steered into the flow of evening rush hour. Their car was still in his mother-in-law's garage, but the truth was way too complicated. Our car is shot, he said. The mechanic wants $2,000 to fix it. Time for a new one.
With what money?
We'll figure it out.
Just don't touch any of Jeffrey's.
Jeffrey's money. Reuben was relieved to hear her put it that way. It meant that Jeffrey had not yet regained his memory about Reuben's involvement, even though Reuben had him brought him cornflakes.
Wouldn't touch it, he said.
Dusk was turning to darkness. The street lamps flickered on. Reuben glanced over, but Savannah was looking straight ahead into the fuzzy glow of oncoming headlights. So? What's up with picking you up at the bus stop?
I spoke with the Department of Children and Family Services today, she said.
Reuben bristled.
Savannah, I told you I didn't want to go that route. I thought it was worth a shot. I was wrong. Not only did they say no way on adoption, but the social worker also said it was best for you not to come on the campus anymore.
That's bullshit. So from now on I have to drop you off and pick you up at the bus stop?
Yes.
They're treating me like a child molester because of a dumbass conviction when I was a teenager?
No, said Savannah.
because of a conviction for domestic violence that you didn't tell me about.
Oh, shit.
Reuben, I want the truth.
She was looking right at him, her laser-like gaze intense enough to burn through metal.
Reuben pulled into a gas station and parked. He gathered his thoughts before speaking.
Her name was Mindy, he said. We lived together for 8 months.
Did you hurt her?
No.
What did you do to her?
Nothing.
Men don't get convicted of domestic violence for doing nothing.
They do when women lie.
So this Mindy is a liar, is that your answer?
Reuben looked away toward the motorists vying for a spot at the gas pumps, then back.
Mindy was a mess. Not as bad as your brother, but bad enough for me to tell her I was moving out if she didn't stop the drugs. A week later, I came home from work and found her totally strung out on meth. That was it.
You left?
Tried to leave.
She went berserk.
Meaning what?
The whole scene was sick. She was crying, hanging on to me, promising never to do it again.
It went beyond begging me to stay. I was shoving my things into a suitcase, and she kept pulling them out and stuffing them back into the drawer. Finally, I just decided to leave everything and go. She grabbed onto me and I shook her loose. That's when her temper took over. She started hitting me.
Did you hit her back?
No. Never. I just kept walking.
What did she do?
He hesitated, his gaze again shifting toward the gas pumps.
You really want to know?
Yes, I want to know.
He looked her in the eye, her face aglow from the dashboard light. She ripped off her blouse, called me a user, and said I should fuck her one more time because that's all I ever wanted anyway. Then she ran into the bedroom and got my gun.
Savannah caught her breath. She was going to shoot you?
I didn't wait to find out. I went for the gun and managed to take it away from her. That's when the cops showed up.
The neighbors heard us arguing and dialed 911.
Did you tell them what happened?
Didn't get the chance. They rushed in with weapons drawn. First thing they saw was Mindy on the floor with her blouse ripped off and me standing over her with a pistol in my hand. In 10 seconds, they had me face down with my hands cuffed behind my back. They took Mindy into the bedroom to talk to her away from me. The story she told them was that she was kicking me out of the apartment and I refused to leave, that I pulled a gun and started ripping off her clothes.
Savannah blinked twice, as if it were too much to process.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's a good word for it, said Reuben,
because nobody believed me.
They believed Mindy.
Did the police give her a lie detector test?
If they did, they didn't tell me about it.
Is there any way you can prove she was lying?
You want me to prove it to you?
Not to me, she said, suddenly energized, as if a bright idea had come to her. To the adoption agencies that turned us down. Maybe they'd change their mind if we could prove that your conviction was based on a lie.
How could I possibly prove that? Mindy and I were the only people in the room.
If you could find some way,
Savannah, forget the adoption agencies, he said, a little too firmly.
The sparkle in her eye faded, gone as quickly as it had appeared. Forget them? I've explored everything. DCF was our last option, and now they've said no.
We don't need DCF.
We don't need the adoption agencies. We do, if we want to adopt the child.
He heard the distress in her voice, had heard it many times before. He reached across the console and took her hand. Actually, we don't. We really don't.
What are you getting at?
There's one more thing you should know about me and Mindy. His tone was apologetic, but Savannah seemed to sense the excitement in his voice, too. He was eager to move beyond saying how sorry he was for what had happened after the motorcycle accident. He was finally able to fix it. What is it, Reuben? He swallowed hard and took a breath. And then he told her. Chapter 33. The sun was setting in her rearview mirror as Andy drove across the causeway to Miami Beach. Special Agent Benny Sosa was with her, but this time it was no undercover date at Night Moves. Andy had the much more delicate assignment of interviewing Octavio Alvarez's girlfriend less than 12 hours after his death. They were about 10 minutes from West Wind Apartments when Andy phoned Lieutenant Watts for the latest on the hit and run.
The only development is more of a non-development, said Watts.
Meaning what, nobody called in and confessed?
That happens, said Watts. But let me give you a more common, for instance. Driver runs over a pedestrian. Driver panics and flees the scene. Driver talks to a smart lawyer. Driver parks his car in the Grove ghetto with the door wide open and the motor running, then calls MDPD and reports that it was stolen an hour or two before the accident.
Andy kept her cynicism in check, but she was suddenly thinking about Barbara Littleford and her poor available cousin. How do you feel about lawyers, Andy? If I hear you correctly, no one called in today to report that his blue sedan was stolen a few hours before this morning's hit and run.
That would be correct, said Watts.
So what does that tell you?
The driver could be afraid to come forward. Maybe he thinks a witness got a look at him. Could be a warrant out for his arrest. Maybe he's an illegal alien.
Maybe he's afraid the police will recognize him as the gunman in the heist. Keep me posted, she said.
Andy thanked him and hung up as the causeway fed her into the North Miami Beach version of Main Street. Palm trees lined the sidewalks. Locals strolled past mom-and-pop restaurants and shops where customers were known by name. Delis and corner markets that were strictly kosher. A gas station that was full service. West Wind Apartments was well away from the older, traditional neighborhood. The two-story white building was just a short walk from the ocean, popular with beach lovers, catering to a mixture of overnight hotel guests, seasonal renters, and year-round tenants. Andy found a parking spot on the street, right behind a long row of Vespas. The Italian-made motor scooters that were the method of transportation in Miami Beach for anyone who fancied himself immortal and zipped around, oblivious to the fact that to the average driver in South Florida, scooters were the equivalent of bugs on a windshield. Andy and Sosa checked in with the attendant at the front desk, who directed them down the hall to apartment 103. A young woman answered, and Andy identified herself with a flash of her badge.
I'm sorry for your loss, said Andy, but we'd like to talk to you about Octavio Alvarez. I already talked to Miami-Dade police. What's this about?
Andy made a strategic decision not to mention the heist. If Jasmine knew about it, she'd say nothing, and whether she knew about it or not, pointed questions from the FBI would only put her on the defensive and shut down the conversation.
Just a follow-up, gathering as many facts as we can about the hit and run.
It was enough to get invited inside. Jasmine Valore was a pretty brunette with the toned body of someone who had no cause for embarrassment at the beach. She wore jean shorts, flip-flops, and a tank top, just like every other young woman Andy had seen on her way into the building. A background check had told Andy that she was a graduate of Miami Beach Senior High and a part-time student at Miami-Dade College with no criminal record.
She lived alone in a small one-bedroom apartment. The smell of cooked oatmeal wafted from the tiny kitchen, a reasonably healthy dinner for a young woman on a budget. The living room was tidy, but space was severely limited. Jasmine had to move her bicycle to make room for guests to sit on the couch.
"This doesn't even seem real to me," said Jasmine, her voice hollow. "I can't believe Octavio is gone. How long did you know him?"
"A few months.
I met him at a party and we got to be friends at first. We started going out over the summer." "Sorry to be personal, but how well did you know him?"
She shrugged.
"He was my boyfriend. He would stay here sometimes, I stayed at his place. We weren't talking about moving in together or getting engaged, if that's what you're asking."
"Are you involved in the funeral arrangements?"
"Yeah. He has no one else. His entire family still lives in Cuba. Braxton is paying for everything. It was part of his benefits. They don't pay squat to their armored car drivers, but at least they have insurance to cover burial costs if something happens."
"When you say they don't pay squat, is that something Octavio told you?
Every once in a while."
"Did he ever talk about ways to fix that?"
"Like what?
Winning the lottery?"
"No, just anything."
Jasmine glanced out the window, her expression turning more serious as her gaze drifted back to Andy.
"There was one thing. We had a pretty big argument when I found out about it. I didn't like it."
Andy reeled in her anticipation.
"Tell me." "The detective from MDPD told me that Octavio was dressed like a homeless guy. I didn't mention this to him, but maybe I should have. All the panhandling at that intersection is controlled. Octavio had a piece of the action. He drove downtown once a week to round up a group of homeless people and took them to Bird Road. They split the money."
This was news to Andy, but it wasn't what she was hoping to hear.
"That's it?" "Yeah. Octavio told me it wasn't illegal, but I thought it was scummy."
"Do you think that's what he was doing at the intersection this morning?"
"It's the only thing that makes sense to me. Maybe he dressed up like a homeless guy and was sort of working undercover, you know, checking up on his team, making sure they weren't goofing off or stealing from him. I just wish he would have listened to me and dropped that stupid gig."
She sniffled back the first sign of tears. "Maybe this wouldn't have happened." Andy studied her expression. Either Jasmine knew nothing about the heist, or she deserved an Academy Award. Andy backed off.
"If I may ask, what are you doing for the funeral arrangements?"
Jasmine sighed.
"The funeral home pretty much takes care of it. They work with the insurance company to pick out the casket and such. Mostly I've been making phone calls, sending emails and text messages, letting Octavio's friends know what happened. Can I ask you a favor? I'd really like to have a list of the people you've called."
"Well," Jasmine hesitated, but Andy didn't read it as anything more than the normal pushback to any invasion of privacy.
"Why do you want that?"
Andy continued to stare clear of the heist.
"We think the driver in the hit and run may be someone who knows Octavio."
"You mean a friend of his?
That's terrible. Why would you think that?"
"If you were Octavio's wife, I would share that level of detail. But as it is, I hope you'll work with us and understand that your list could be very useful to our investigation.
I don't really have a list. I've just been calling people as I think of it.
Could you give me the names of his closest friends?" Jasmine got her phone from the coffee table and rattled off a few names and numbers. Andy jotted them down. None was familiar, and Pinky was not among them.
"Any others?" asked Andy.
"I'm sure I forgot someone," said Jasmine. "It's a work in progress, especially with Octavio's older friends.
I could make a final list and give it to you.
Perfect, said Andy. There's one other thing I'd like you to do.
When is the funeral?
Thursday or Friday. It depends when the medical examiner releases the body.
Is there an online registry where people can post memories of Octavio or express condolences?
Yeah, that's part of the package deal with the funeral home. It should be up tonight.
Good. Here's what I want you to do. Before the funeral, make a list of everyone you think should be there. After the funeral, circle the name of anyone on that list who doesn't show up. Then go through the list again. If someone whose name is circled didn't call you, didn't respond to your text or email, or didn't go to the online registry to post something, I want you to put a star next to that person's name. Can you do that?
Yes, of course.
But can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Is there someone in particular you're looking for?
The answer to that is yes, said Andy.
You're not going to tell me his name, are you? Andy shook her head.
No, Jasmine.
You are. Chapter 34. Reuben was waiting for a response, any response, but Savannah appeared numb. They were still parked in her mother's car at the gas station, Savannah staring through the windshield at nothing.
You have a child,
she said finally. It wasn't really a question, more of an expression of disbelief.
And you never told me.
I didn't even know Mindy was pregnant when I moved out. It was one of the reasons my lawyer advised me to plead guilty and avoid jail time. I told him the abuse charges were all a lie, but he said I would have to be crazy to stand trial with a pregnant ex-girlfriend accusing me.
Finally, she looked at him. Half of her face was in darkness, the other half aglow from the lights around the gas station.
I don't know what to say, Reuben.
You're acting like this is totally a bad thing.
How is it a good thing?
Don't you see what I'm getting at? Savannah.
Kyla could be our child. We could adopt her.
Her mouth fell open.
No, we can't. I'm serious. We can make this happen. Make it happen. You can't just throw something like this at me before you even know if I want it to happen.
But this is what you've always wanted.
Yes, but not like this. Hey, honey, I had a child with another woman. Hey, let's adopt her. Hey, isn't that a great idea? Shit, Reuben.
So you'd adopt a stranger's child, but not my child?
I didn't say that. Don't make me the bad guy here.
Reuben reached for his phone.
I took a picture of her. Let me show.
No! Don't do that to me!
Reuben paused for a moment, just long enough for the tension to break.
Sorry. You're right. That's not fair.
No, not fair at all, said Savannah. Because even if I wanted this to happen, it can't. You're talking in circles. A felony conviction for domestic violence is a deal killer for adoption. Period. End of story.
No, he said. There is one clear exception.
There's no exception, said Savannah. I talked to DCF.
Not about this, you didn't. I'm allowed to adopt my own biological child if I can get the consent of everyone who has parental rights.
Savannah blinked hard as if trying to make sense of it.
Honestly, I don't know if that's true or not. But put that aside. You were convicted of domestic violence. Why would your ex-girlfriend consent to the adoption?
Kyla's mother is irrelevant. She's in jail. Kyla's grandmother, Edith, is the only person with parental rights. She adopted Kyla.
Fine. Why would Kyla's grandmother consent
after you were convicted of abusing her daughter. This is a hopeless situation.
I've talked to Edith. She's willing to let the adoption go through. Savannah did a double take.
I don't understand. How could she do that?
Think about it, Savannah. Would Edith consent to the adoption if the domestic violence charges against me were valid?
He could almost see her mind at work, but he didn't wait for her response.
The answer is clearly no, he said. Mindy's own mother knows that those accusations and my conviction were bogus. That's the only reason she would consent.
Savannah still seemed troubled.
I just don't understand. Even if it was all a lie, why would anyone give up a child she adopted and raised for almost 5 years?
Reuben hesitated. It was the moment of truth. The cash. She's not just giving Kyla up to anyone. I am the father. She's also raising two other kids that Mindy had with other men, so Edith has more than she can handle. I think she feels guilty about the way the whole conviction went down and how it's keeping us from adopting our own child now and...
And what?
Back to that moment of truth. Money, money, money. Reuben couldn't go there. I told her about you. What a great mother you would be.
Really?
Yeah. The way this played out, it was all about you. That was the tipping point.
Savannah's expression started to change, as did her posture. She seemed to be opening up.
I'm going to think about this.
You should.
I'm not promising that I'm going to say this is a good idea.
I understand.
But if we do move forward, when can I meet her?
Kyla? Savannah shook her head.
No. We're nowhere near that point. Edith. I would want to talk to Kyla's grandmother first.
Oh. She was waiting for more. Reuben was searching for words.
Oh, said Savannah. That's all you can say?
I hadn't really thought about you meeting Edith.
You didn't think we would adopt Kyla without me meeting the grandmother, did you?
Is that really necessary?
Savannah shot him an expression of curiosity. Is there some reason you don't want me to meet her?
No, not at all.
Is there some reason she wouldn't want to meet me?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, then. There you have it. Why don't you see if you can make that happen?
A meeting between you and Edith.
Or the three of us, if that's more comfortable for her.
Reuben drew a breath.
It wasn't the plan he'd envisioned, but he saw no conceivable way to convince Savannah the meeting shouldn't happen. Unless, of course, Edith refused to meet with her.
All right, said Reuben. I'll take care of it.
Chapter 35. The tilapia in the refrigerator still smelled fresh, so Savannah cooked it up with steamed kale and wild rice for dinner. Reuben had a full night at the restaurant and couldn't stay, so she ate alone at the kitchen counter. The house was too quiet, and the fifth mental replay of her talk with Reuben about Kyla was the point of overload. She grabbed the TV remote and switched on the local news. The lead story was a hit-and-run traffic fatality during the morning rush hour, but it didn't really capture Savannah's attention until the exclusive live report shifted to the street outside Braxton Security Headquarters. The victim has been identified as 28-year-old Octavio Alvarez, the reporter said into the camera, microphone in hand.
In a breaking development, Eyewitness News has confirmed that Mr. Alvarez was one of the Braxton security guards on duty when, little more than 2 weeks ago, thieves made off with nearly $10 million in cash from a warehouse at Miami International Airport.
Savannah almost dropped her fork. The reporter continued, fighting off a long wisp of hair that was caught in the gentle evening breeze.
While the heist remains unsolved, sources tell Eyewitness News that law enforcement has been actively investigating the possibility of an inside job. Miami-Dade police have declined to comment on any suspected connection to this morning's fatal hit-and-run accident involving the Braxton Guard, but we will keep viewers apprised of any further developments. Reporting live from Doral, this is Cynthia.
Savannah hit the mute button, grabbed her phone, and speed-dialed Ruben. The clatter of a busy restaurant was in the background, and she nearly had to shout for Ruben to hear her.
"Slow down," said Ruben. "What's the matter?"
She told him, her voice racing.
"Octavio who?"
he asked.
"Diaz, no, Alvarez, I don't know. The important thing is that the news made it sound like he could have been part of the heist."
"Did you talk to Jeffrey?"
It seemed like an odd first question.
"No. Jeffrey still doesn't know I know anything."
"Okay, good. Don't talk to him."
"Don't talk to him? Ruben, this is serious. First it was my uncle's friend, now it's the guard from Braxton. Two of the people involved are dead, and you say don't talk to Jeffrey? What if he's next?"
"He's not."
"How do you know that?"
"Because..."
He stopped short and asked her to hold on. The restaurant noises in the background faded as he'd apparently moved to some place more private. "We don't have to worry about Jeffrey," he said. "It's Pinky who concerns me."
"Forget him. My uncle can take care of himself. Jeffrey can't."
"That's not my point. I don't see Pinky as next on the hit list. I think he's behind what happened to these two guys." Savannah felt chills.
"Then we need to go to the police," she said. "I don't care if he's my uncle."
"We can't go to the police. Your uncle has me in a box."
"What are you talking about?"
Savannah waited for a response, and she could almost sense him struggling over the line. Then he answered, "There's something I need to tell you."
"Then tell me."
"Do you promise you won't get mad?" he asked. "No matter how bad it is?"
"Ruben, just tell me what is going on."
"Okay. Here's the deal. Do you remember that Sunday night when I came home late and told you that it wasn't an intervention, that Jeffrey and your uncle pulled off the heist?"
"How could I forget that?"
"I told you that I made them hide the money until we figured out what to do. You and I agreed that we should do what we could to keep Jeffrey out of jail."
"Yes, I remember all that."
"And you were so grateful to me for helping out your family."
"Yes, Ruben, what are you getting at?"
He breathed so heavily that it crackled over the line. "Your uncle is using that against me."
"I don't understand. He's blackmailing me, Savannah.
If we go to the police, he is going to tell them that I was part of the heist." She couldn't speak for a moment. And then it came all at once.
"Oh my God! What? How?"
"He's going to tell the cops I was his accomplice. I'll go to jail."
"No! He can't get away with that! Jeffrey will stand up for you. He knows you weren't involved."
"The police will think Jeffrey is lying to protect his brother-in-law. Your uncle is holding all the cards right now. He can put me away for the next 30 years. Savannah's hand was shaking, and she gripped the phone a little tighter to steady her nerves.
Reuben, I am so sorry.
Don't apologize. It's not your fault.
But you were just trying to help Jeffrey, and now you're caught in the middle.
I can handle this, he said. But you have to stick with me. We cannot go to the police. Not yet.
When?
As soon as I figure out how to deal with your uncle.
Do you really think he killed these two men?
I really do. I've called his phone, and the number doesn't work anymore. He quit showing up for work. He never goes to his apartment. Plus, I just think he's capable of doing something like this.
It wasn't the most far-fetched thing she'd ever heard, but a thief in the family was one thing. A murderer was quite another.
I'm scared for Jeffrey.
You don't need to be.
He's already been kidnapped once.
That was my fault for trying to scare him. It had nothing to do with what your uncle did to his friend Marco and Octavio Alvarez.
I'm still scared, Reuben. There's no reason to be, Savannah.
As bad as your uncle is, he's not going to hurt his sister's kids. You and Jeffrey have nothing to worry about.
What about you?
You hid the money.
What if he goes after you?
I'll be okay.
She stopped pacing and stood at the counter. From there, she could see down the hallway all the way to the locked cabinet in the other room.
Reuben, are you carrying a gun?
It's not anything to worry about.
Did you take one of your pistols from the cabinet?
I'm taking precautions, he said.
I don't like this. People are dying. You're packing a gun. Jeffrey is...
She stopped herself, sensing that he wasn't listening. She overheard him speaking to someone in the background, then he was back on the line.
Savannah, I have to go now. We can talk more about this when I get home.
I'm not staying here by myself.
If I thought you were in danger, I would be the first one to tell you to get out of the house, but you're not.
I'm going to my mother's place. Pick me up there.
How are you going to get there? You don't have a car.
She breathed out, exasperated.
I'll take the bus. Okay, go to your mom's. That's a good plan.
But this is all going to be okay, Savannah. I promise. And I love you.
He said goodbye and hung up before her reply.
Love you too, she said to no one.
She immediately dialed her mother. Jeffrey answered.
Is Mom home? She asked. I want to come over for a while.
Yeah, she's here. What time are you coming?
It could be an hour. I have to take the bus.
No, I'll pick you up.
With what car?
Yours. It's in our garage.
Reuben said the engine shot.
That's bullshit. He told me the same thing so I wouldn't drive it. There's nothing wrong with the engine. I've been driving it all day.
Savannah hesitated, not sure what to say.
Why would he swap cars?
I don't know. Ask him.
Another lie. Best to keep Jeffrey out of this. I will.
You want me to pick you up or not?
Can you come get me now?
Sure. Be there in 10 minutes.
The call ended, and Savannah laid the phone on the counter, her mind a whirl. The lies and half-truths were starting to pile up, and the best spin she could put on it was that Reuben was trying to protect her and keep her from worrying. The spin was getting harder to swallow. She walked to the end of the kitchen counter where her daycare satchel lay. Tomorrow's lesson plan was inside. Group time, story time, small group activities. Tucked beside it was another folder, which contained copies of the court records that the DCF social worker had given her. Savannah glanced over the papers once more, then dialed Betty's home number.
I'm so sorry to call you at home.
Not at all, said Betty. I said you could call me whenever, and I meant it.
I have a favor to ask, said Savannah. I was looking over the records you gave me.
I noticed that the victim's name is blocked out. Yes, her identity was sealed by court order. That's not the typical situation in domestic violence cases, but it's not unheard of. Reuben told me her first name is Mindy. Is there any way to find out her last name? Why don't you just ask your husband? I could do that, she said, drawing a breath. But I don't want him to know that I'm looking into this. Ah, I see. Savannah, are you having some difficulties? No, nothing to worry about. It's like I told you earlier. I'm concerned about you. You don't have to be. Okay. I won't pry. But why do you want to know her name? Savannah swallowed hard. Perhaps Reuben would have a perfectly good explanation for the little lie about the car engine, and she could probably forgive him for that. But if there were still more lies, bigger lies, she wasn't so sure. I want to talk to Mindy, said Savannah. I want to know the truth about her and Reuben. There was silence on the line. Then Betty answered. I'll see what I can do. Savannah took one more look at the docket sheet in the case of State of Florida versus Carl Betancourt, her finger running over the printed black bars that obscured the victim's name. Thank you, said Savannah. Thank you very much.
Chapter 36. The call from Savannah left Reuben's brain throbbing. A stabbing pain behind his right eye forced him to dim the lights and sit quietly at his desk for a minute. It was his classic stress headache. He was alone in the cramped office at Cafe Reuben, which wasn't much of an office at all. There was no window. The constant clatter of the kitchen came right through the walls. The only way to open the closet door was to pick up and move the printer and the fax machine. The filing cabinets were somewhere behind 30-pound bags of rice, canned chicken stock, and the overflow of other dry goods from the stockroom. Reuben tucked his cell into his pocket, leaned back in his squeaky desk chair, and closed his eyes, willing the headache away. It was only getting worse. Lies. More lies. There were almost too many to keep track of. He'd come so close to telling Savannah the truth about the heist, even closer than on the night he'd climbed into their bed with the smell of money on his hands and lied for the first time. He wasn't sure when he'd conjured up the story that Pinky was threatening to blackmail him if they went to the police, that Pinky had the power to put Reuben away for 30 years, and that Savannah just needed to stand by her man and all would work out. Such a great lie. It almost felt like the truth. If it was in fact Pinky who killed Marco and Octavio, it wouldn't be long before Reuben was in his crosshairs. The lie he'd told Savannah wasn't all that far from the truth. So why is my head pounding? There was a knock at the door, and his assistant manager stuck her head into the room.
Our sous chef is threatening to walk out again. I've had it with him. You need to deal with this.
Reuben's head chef had the night off, leaving the sous chef in charge. I'll be there in 2 minutes, he said.
Okay, but it's getting pretty intense, and there are lots of knives in that kitchen.
She was only half kidding. But Reuben seemed to recall that an argument at a fine restaurant in Coral Gables had been settled in that very fashion. The thought triggered a moment of panic. Reuben unlocked the desk drawer and opened it. To his relief, the gun was still there. No armed lunatic in the kitchen. Reuben had always kept a gun at the restaurant just in case, but Savannah's instincts had been correct. After the hit and run, he'd gone to his cabinet at home and swapped out the revolver for a pistol with more firepower. Reuben wasn't eager to use it. In fact, he was determined to avoid a confrontation with Pinky, at least until the immediate shock and anger over the hit and run subsided.
He couldn't say what he would do if he met up with Pinky in his current frame of mind. Would he feel the impulse to avenge his friend?